Welcome to the Nation of Writers podcast, presented in conjunction with our exhibit American Voices, which you can explore in person or online at nationofwriters.org. In this episode, we'll discuss the life and work of poet Phyllis Wheatley Peters. Kidnapped in West Africa, Wheatley Peters was renamed after the ship that brought her to Boston to be sold as a slave. A precocious child, she was given an education which was unusual at the time when enslaved African Americans could be punished for knowing how to read. At the age of 20, Wheatley Peters became the first published African American author with poems on various subjects, religious and moral, in 1773. The acclaim she received both in American colonies and abroad must have been particularly sweet after enduring earlier skepticism about her ability to write. She gained her freedom in 1778, but died impoverished at only the age of 31. For this episode, we are pleased to speak with Barbara McCaskill, Muna Narayan, and Sarah Robbins, co-directors of the Wheatley Peters Project, which aims to preserve and honor her legacy. You can read their full bios in the episode description. Barbara, Muna, and Sarah are interviewed by Nate King, Digital Content Associate at the American Writers Museum. This conversation originally took place July 26th, 2023, and was recorded over Zoom.
Well, thank you, Sarah, Barbara, and Mona for joining me on the Nation of Writers podcast. I'm excited to talk to you all about Phyllis Wheatley, an important poet, though often, unfortunately, misremembered or kind of forgotten in the American canon. But the work y'all are doing is great. But before we get into Wheatley's history and work, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your relationship to Wheatley and the work you do regarding her? Sarah, perhaps you could get us started.
Yes, I will. Thank you. And in terms of our relationship to Phyllis Wheatley, often now referred to as Phyllis Wheatley Peters, we're working on a year-long project that we began back in January of 2023 and that will run through the rest of the year in honor of the anniversary of the 1773 publication of her poems book, about which we'll probably say a little bit more. But I just want to start by encouraging people to participate in the project, because this is a participatory humanities project, and folks can go to our website at wheatleypetersproject.weebly.com and see a whole series of virtual events that they can join this fall, including a September session with two poets who have published collections inspired by their own study of who we call in shorthand PWP, Drea Brown and Allison Clark. An October session on Wheatley Peters-related children's lit, and a November wrap-up panel of some wonderful scholars looking ahead to future research on Phyllis Wheatley Peters. And if they visit the website regularly, folks will find that we're continuing to add resources across the year for both personal engagement with Phyllis Wheatley and classroom teachers who may want to teach Wheatley Peters in their classrooms. I came to Wheatley myself through a classroom at University of Michigan in the 1990s, and a course on transatlantic literature taught by the amazing Julie Ellison. And we began the course with Phyllis Wheatley Peters. And more recently, I had the privilege of editing three entries on PWP's writing for transatlantic Anglophone literature. So a lot of my engagement with Wheatley Peters is through a kind of transatlantic lens. So that's a good way maybe to position me in relation to her. Maybe Barbara, you should say a little bit about your connection to our project and also your own history with Wheatley Peters.
Sure. I came to Phyllis Wheatley Peters at a very young age. My first recollection of learning about her was around second or third grade. My parents were very interested in our learning about African American literature, and we didn't get much of that in the classroom. So my parents would always buy books about African American literature and history and culture. And one of those books, which I still have in my office today, was called Great Negroes Past and Present. And it was published by the Johnson Publishing Company, the great printing conglomerate that published Ebony Magazine. And it contained biographies of Black Atlantic figures, people like Toussaint Louverture, Frederick Douglass, from all over the world. And Phyllis Wheatley was one of the entries. And I remember being amazed at, first of all, how beautiful she looked. There was a drawing of her that was quite beautiful. And also, I was amazed at the fact that she had written poetry while she was enslaved. I teach Phyllis Wheatley Peters all the time, even though my teaching focuses on 19th, 20th, and 21st century African American literature. We can't talk about African American literature without talking about Phyllis Wheatley Peters. She is one of the OGs of African American literature, the godmothers of African American literature, and for that matter, American literature.
Yeah, that's a great point. I love that. And Mona, how about yourself?
So I came to Phyllis Wheatley Peters fairly late in the game, so to speak. I encountered her first in a graduate course on British literature, 19th century British literature. And we just read a couple of poems by her. And at that time, I didn't pay a whole lot of attention. It's only when I got interested in diaspora literature and women and gender studies that I really started to pay attention to her work. And the book that I will say and the authors that I will say really led me to be interested in her is a very famous now collection, Black Writers in Britain, 1760 to 1890, edited by Paul Edwards and David Davideen, whom I had been studying previously, who has written extensively about Blacks in Britain. And that really kind of opened my eyes to Wheatley Peters. And I continue to teach her in both undergraduate and graduate classes. But I'm also doing work on Phyllis Wheatley Peters' writing as part of the oceanic and broadly transatlantic, but specifically located within Britain, global connotations of her work. So that's where my research lies.
That's great. Fascinating. And the mentioning Britain and the transatlantic literatures, maybe now's a good time to provide a little bit of historical background and context for our listeners on, you know, maybe just a brief little bio of Phyllis Wheatley. Sarah, would you like to kick
sure,
us off on
I'll,
that?
Yeah. I'll start and just say one of the ways that I've been fascinated to think about her historically recently is through the children's literature. I'm actually going to use a text in my class in the fall by Afua Cooper, who is both a poet and a scholar located in Canada. And a literary activist, I guess, is how I would describe her. And her her biography, My Name is Phyllis Wheatley, is, I think, a great choice for, say, high school students, but I'm also going to use it with my college students, partly because she starts in a place that some people haven't treated in much detail, and that is Wheatley's early life when she wasn't Phyllis Wheatley in Africa, before she was captured and carried across through the Middle Passage to Boston, where she was bought by the Wheatley family. And then through their relatively kind, if we can ever imagine enslavement being kind, relatively speaking, giving her the chance to acquire literacy and become a poet. As I'm sure we'll hear more about from my wonderful colleagues. And maybe that's a good lead-in to saying, thinking about Wheatley in this kind of British colonial context that she was originally in when she was first came to what we now see as the U.S., she was really influenced by that positionality and her study of British writers. So Mona, maybe you should tell us a little bit about the main influences on Wheatley's writing.
Oh, absolutely. I would love to. So actually, I'm going to talk briefly about four different influences in sort of groups. And the first one I would say is her classical learning, which is really a deep study of Virgil, Ovid, and Homer. which affect her style of writing. And I know we'll be talking more about that later. But in the choices that she makes about the form of her poetry, for example, she writes verse epistles that really emerge from Virgil's work, right? And then she also has a way of talking about odysseys, including her own, so to speak, very differently, though, from Homer, but still a lot of allusion to Homer. The second group, I would say, is English writers, right? Because she was very much a British subject at the time that she was growing up in the United States, or what would later become United States. But she was a British subject at that time. So she was reading certainly a lot of John Milton. Paradise Lost is a major influence. She was reading Alexander Pope, because the neoclassical elements of her poetry are really startling to see how she not only draws upon them, but really innovates on them, right? And elegies, you know, so we're thinking really of Thomas Hubbard or Thomas Gray's elegy writing that influences her. She wrote a number of elegies. Those were one of the major forms of writing that she did, which are really songs of mourning. And that comes both from the classical and British influences. But I would be remiss if I wouldn't mention that the Bible and Christian theology are major, perhaps the most overarching influence on her work, both in terms of form and content, as well as the style, right? And last but not the least, what Sarah just mentioned, she comes from what scholars now believe the Wolof ethnic group in the Gambia-Senegal region of Africa. And they used to use indigenous forms of writing. And one of her earlier biographers talks about her making marks as a very young child on walls. And that is how she caught the Wheatleys' attention, that she was perhaps putting Arabic words on the wall. So at that time, certainly children of 6 to 8, due to the Islamicization of Africa at that time, would have certainly learned to recite Quran or passages from the Quran by heart. And it is very evident that Wheatley brings a whole different tradition of understanding and literacy from her younger ages that moves beyond the Western context. So that's the fourth context that I wanted to draw out that really influenced her work. And Barbara, you, I'm sure, would have other things to add to this from the American context.
Sure. From the American side, I'd merely like to add that more and more as scholars and readers, we recognize that although she was enslaved by the Wheatley family, as my colleagues have pointed out, Wheatley did not work, write, and create in isolation. She reached out to other people of color and corresponded with other literate people of color. She would have interacted with people of color in the marketplace, in the churches, as Honoré Jeffers, the great poet, imagines in her take on Phyllis Wheatley, the age of Phyllis. So I think that we must also contemplate ways in which Phyllis Wheatley grew as an artist by interacting with other artists of color, small though that community may have been, not just writers, but also painters, musicians. She really was representative of how people of African descent on the American continent created communities of color that nurtured them as artists and writers.
That's a great point, yeah. And it's interesting too, because those sorts of, at least in my, education, those sorts of communities aren't, mentioned that often or brought up or even, but it is, inspiring to know that they existed and were, thriving, at a time when they were, enslaved. And, a thing I found fascinating in my research, of Phyllis Wheatley Peters was how she had access to, or was given access, I guess, to reading materials and was, instructed, Susanna Wheatley, right? Was the, the woman. Yeah. And, What about Phyllis Wheatley do you think, or perhaps you've learned this in your research, is precocious the right word? As a young girl, was she able to learn quickly, what do you think Susanna saw in Phyllis Wheatley that lent her to educate her and as best she could?
Well, first of all, as I mentioned, her early biographers note that, and they may have heard it or they may actually have seen it, that she was making marks on the wall, and she seemed to be really invested in writing. And the other thing that I think made it interesting is because as the Wheatleys saw that she was interested in literacy, so to speak, in broad terms, they started to educate her, and she learned very fast. So she was proficient in English in less than 2 years. And then she went on to learn classical languages. So she did have exposure to Greek and Latin as well. And then she was reading ferociously, might be the word to use it, because she just consumed texts based on what we know from her life. Barbara, what would you like to add to that?
Sure. We can really only conjecture as to what the Wheatley family, because we mm-hmm. remember also that she interacted with the children, might have seen in her that would have encouraged them to nurture her gifts. We use the word genius to describe her in mm-hmm. the Phyllis Wheatley programs and series that we have put together over the last year. But I think that in a way that is misleading, because yes, she was extraordinarily gifted, precocious, accomplished, talented, all of those words apply. But she also exhibited something that was consistent among so many other Africans in America, particularly enslaved Africans in America, and that was a resilience, an ability to find meaning in struggle, to find meaning in trauma. She endures because of that as well. And I would like to believe that the Wheatleys were impressed. That doesn't seem to be the right word to use. Probably more stunned and shocked at her ability to so quickly overcome the trauma of the Middle Passage. Imagine, she was very young, 7, 8 years old, we surmise, when she crossed over in the hull of a slave ship, watching people die around her, starve around her, lose their minds around her. Just the family's recognition of what she had come through, losing her family, yet finding in language an anchor, a mooring, a meaning that so many others would have just been lost to.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And a testament to the the power of language to do that. Barbara, what you just said, part of it made me think, a thing that really impressed me in researching her was her go-get-it-ness, she was a hustler.
Yes,
you know, she absolutely. Was self-promoter, worked hard to get her work published. I'm wondering if you all could tell us a little bit about that process that she went through to, because she started, first poems were published when she was a teenager, right? Or
absolutely.
Like 12 or 13.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So then, maybe just take us through her writing career, and what she had to go through to get words on paper. Barbara, do you want to kick us off on that one?
Well, we know that she reached out to prominent Americans like George Washington when he was a general in the Revolutionary War to share her poetry. And that reflected her, first of all, her interest in the Republican ideals of the revolution. They certainly were compatible with her own experience having lost freedom, but she also was being very savvy by sharing her poetry with the likes of George Washington on the American side, and then, of course, and Mona can speak to this, a coterie of aristocratic Britons across the Atlantic. She knew that she needed to get in front of the right people to publish her poetry, to circulate her poetry, to sell her poetry, and to create an enduring legacy. And the confidence that she displayed at such a young age doing that is mind-boggling. It's amazing, even now. Certainly, she would have been encouraged by the Wheatley family, particularly Susanna, but also something inside of herself propelled her to put herself forward and to imagine that she could be a writer. Though enslaved, though taken from her homeland, though taken from her family. I think that's one reason, perhaps, that imagination as a theme occurs so consistently and prominently in her poetry. It certainly is a gesture to neoclassical literature, as Mona has pointed out, but it also speaks to something in herself that recognized her ability to create imaginary worlds, to compel others to join her in this process, to imagine a country that was not subjected to a monarchy, to imagine a people who could be free. And there was something inside her that gave her the confidence. I like to use the word will, because I see this in so many other narratives and biographies of formerly enslaved Africans. What they have in common is a will that enables them not only to think beyond their circumstances, but also to act beyond their circumstances, because they realize rather pragmatically that they are on their own, that the protection of a family like the Wheatleys, as affectionate as the Wheatleys seem to have been towards her, their protection was precarious. It was not guaranteed. We know that Wheatley saw people of African descent being sold on, she was auctioned, of course, famously on the Boston dock. She was named after the ship that brought her from the African continent to America. More so than other Americans around her, she would have realized that she was never secure. She had to become her own security. And I think we see that in her willingness to circulate her own poetry, not in front of only ordinary, everyday Americans or would-be Americans, but also in front of prominent people who had the money, who had the connections, and who had the leisure time and the appreciation for the kind of work that she was doing.
This might be a good time to mention, in fact, that while we're celebrating the anniversary of her famous book, she was actually already famous when the book came out in 1773. And many of her publications prior to that, you know, collection of poetry in book form were published in broadsides, so single sheets, right? And she had a really savvy understanding, to pick up on Barbara's point, of who the movers and shakers were. And she was writing about those people and to those people in Boston and beyond. And so her poetry was circulating in multiple versions, multiple copies on both sides of the Atlantic. She was already well known when she moved to toward getting that book published. And she was managing really a writing career while still a teenager. And so one of the things that I think is really exciting about studying her for kids is to see the power of writing that even a young person, an adolescent person, can really, and we see that today in folks who are operating in social media at a really young age and capitalizing on the genre features available to them and thinking about the audiences that they can reach. And I think that's one of the connections that young people can make to studying Phyllis Wheatley. And I call her Phyllis Wheatley because this is in the period well before her marriage to, you know, to John Peters, when, as Barbara says, she's still dependent on the Wheatleys and yet operating even in this constrained space available to her to really build, you know, build a career. And maybe Mona can say a little bit about the connections that she was making in Britain during this period.
So what I'll add to this is that the publication of the volume, of her first volume, was actually in England. Both the Wheatleys, particularly Susanna Wheatley, and she tried to find enough patrons and subscribers in Boston, and that didn't work out. So they put her on a ship, the London Packet, to London with their son, Nathaniel Wheatley, and she was able to find a publisher there. And actually, I have a little bit of a passage that might really put some light on all the things that Barbara and Sarah are talking about in response to your question. This is from a October 18, 1773 letter to David Wooster. And this is the last paragraph there. She says, I expect my books, which are published in London, in Captain Hall, who will be here, I believe, in 8 or 10 days, I beg the favor that you would honor the enclosed proposals and use your interest with gentlemen and ladies of your acquaintance to subscribe also, for the more subscribers there are, the more it will be to my advantage, as I am to have half of the sale of the books. Right. And so that really encapsulates in this letter the perfect description, in her own words, of all that Barbara and Sarah are talking about Wheatley as this really global writer. And I know that Barbara and Sarah will speak about her influences on American literature, but it would be remiss of us if we didn't talk about how this very active, well-known writer, whose volume of poetry was very well received in Britain and Europe, really impacts other writers in Europe and Britain as well.
Thank you all for that. I did want to talk about her. We talked about some of the writers that influenced her, but I'm very curious to see if to learn about the writers that followed her, that were influenced by her. We mentioned it earlier, it's kind of, you know, hard not to, you know, she was the first, right? So everyone else, she, you know, maybe opened some doors and stuff. But I'm curious, Barbara, maybe you can start us off on this one. Where do you see her literary lineage in today's world, or maybe even just throughout the last couple of centuries?
Sure. Well, I'll begin really with the 19th century and really the end of the 18th century as well, as the anti-slavery movement in the United States picked up steam. Wheatley becomes central as a voice, of course, for freedom, for autonomy, for the actualization of America's Republican principles, and both white and black writers gesture to her, appropriate her, and use her, reprint her material over and over again in their anthologies, particularly in the newspapers that come out of the anti-slavery movement, really on both sides of the Atlantic. Well after her death, she is repurposed as a voice for the destruction, for the end of American enslavement. And well after, in fact, emancipation in the United States, she continues, her work continues to be reprinted, republished, not only to call attention to ways in which the United States still must continue to grant the full rights of citizenships to African Americans, but what I find very interesting about Wheatley and what I'm writing about now is ways in which Wheatley becomes central to the process of building an actual African American canon of literature. In the earliest bibliographies of African American literature written by people like Arturo Schomburg, for whom the great Schomburg Library is named after, Wheatley appears consistently as an exemplar, as a model for the best of African American writing, but not only that, as a persuasive example of why African American writing should be considered as literature, because of course that was one of the debates that swirled around the voices of African Americans like Wheatley. Were they, even Frederick Douglass sometimes was subject to these accusations, were Black writers original? Were Black writers imaginative? Or were our writers merely imitative and very good at that? So it becomes a project not merely of culture building, but also of liberation for African American generations following Phyllis Wheatley to call attention to her work, to its endurance, both in England, Great Britain, really, and the United States, as well as worldwide. It becomes very important to call attention to the role in which her work has played in building an African American canon as part of the persuasive argument for not only the humanity of African Americans, but for our rights as citizens in these United States. So I like to think of her influence on American literature as two-pronged. We see American writers thinking about Wheatley, repurposing her, quoting her, generating their own ideas through her, but we also see American writers building a canon of African American literature with her, along with other luminaries, early Black writers, as foundational. I'd also like to point out how in certain moments of the development of American literature, Wheatley has been more in vogue than in others. There's going to be a festival in her name in November at Jackson State University, an historically Black university, that actually is honoring a festival that occurred 50 years ago. And that was an interesting moment when African American women poets came together to think about poetry not merely as cultural, but also as political. And sometimes Wheatley's poetry during that era, 50 years ago, roughly around the late 70s and late 60s, about a 10-year period, during that 10-year period, in the aftermath of the Civil Rights Movement, a period that we call the Black Arts Movement, Wheatley's poetry was not altogether appreciated because her voice sounded so old-fashioned because of its neoclassical and, quite frankly, biblical elements, because her themes didn't always ring as relevant to younger generations of African Americans who were thinking about crime, who were thinking about access to education, access to jobs. She's come and gone as a heroine to Black writers and readers and American writers and readers. But more important is for us to remember that she's always come back. And in fact, the very people who denigrate her, once they read her work, come away amazed at how relevant her ideas remain to those of us living and working today in this world today.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, how her sort of reception kind of comes in waves. And it is interesting that you wasn't at that during the Black Arts Movement, it wasn't like you said appreciated that much, or kind of they were the way they were reading her work was not in line with the, their ideals and what they were fighting for. But like you said, she never goes away. She always comes back. It's just
and
a fascinating.
Fact, some of the greatest poems about Phyllis Wheatley by contemporary writers came out of the Black Arts Movement. One of the poems that I like to teach is by June Jordan, who cut her teeth during the Black Arts Movement. And she has a wonderful poem called Something Like a Sonnet for Phyllis Miracle Wheatley. And it's a beautiful tribute, a beautiful example of wordplay and such a meaningful tribute to the mark that Phyllis Wheatley left on American literature and on world literature. So again, even her greatest detractors eventually came around and recognized the power and the endurance of Wheatley as a literary figure. And I also should say that in spite of the ups and downs in terms of reception history that that Wheatley has experienced in literature, in terms of African American culture, she has always been recognized, lauded, valorized. From the 19th century to now, we see buildings, we see schools, we see clubs named in her honor. Particularly at the turn into the 20th century, when schools were segregated, when African Americans were very concerned with historical erasure, Wheatley becomes very important in this project of reminding young Black school children of our history and of the contributions that we have made culturally. I'm thinking, for example, of how Carter Woodson, who created what is now known as Black History Month, important historian, one of the early Black graduates of Harvard, he sponsored and underwrote through one of his organizations plays or pageants about historical African-American figures, heroes and heroines. Phyllis Wheatley was included in that. And in fact, as part of our Wheatley series this November here at the University of Georgia, we are going to reenact a pageant about Wheatley's life that the great club woman and educator Mary Church Terrell created in 1926. So even though Phyllis Wheatley, again, may have fallen out of favor from time to time in literary circles, in terms of being important as a cultural figure and consistently being recognized as that, those of us in the United States, we've never dropped the ball.
Yeah, maybe we can talk about her writing a little bit, get into the details of that for a little bit. I would say perhaps her themes are enduring and relevant, but what about her writing itself do you think lends itself to, you know, reading and still reading today, or perhaps what do you tell your students when you introduce Phyllis Wheatley, like, you know, why, you know, if someone says, why should I read this? What do you say to those students?
Sure. So one of the most important things I think Wheatley does that students love is talk about memory and memorization. And that's what she does in her elegies. But I'm going to actually quote a poem, short lines from her poem, that I think are really important in this moment in time, drawing on all that Sarah and Barbara have said so far in your really astute questions. This is from her poem to the University of Cambridge in New England, and it was published in 1773. Of course, at that time, Harvard was limited only to very wealthy white males, and she addresses these students, and she says, "Students, to you 'tis given to scan the heights above, to traverse the ethereal space and mark the systems of revolving worlds. Improve your privilege while they stay, ye pupils, and each hour redeem that bears, or good or bad report of you to heaven, right? So what she's doing in these lines is really saying to all of us, not just students, that we have a responsibility if we have literacy. And no matter where you're from, she uses her poetry, her very carefully metered poetry, because she writes in ways that are extremely compact and very difficult verse, right? And then she exhorts students to follow the privilege they have been granted and make something of it, right? And so for this moment, for young people or for older people who are involved in hearing this podcast, what she's saying to all of us is that go out and make use of this knowledge. Use what you have learned from me or from other places and implement that. Broaden your minds, but make it further for good so that you're answerable to the heavens. And so in that sense, her writing style is both extremely efficient, very difficult meters, but also always to a purpose. I'll let Sarah pick it up there.
Well, I'm glad you said that phrase, her writing, because so often when we read an author who's been canonized, they and their writing become this enshrined object. And we forget that there were processes of composition and revision. And because a lot of my work is in cultural rhetoric and writing studies, one of the things I love to teach through Wheatley is revision, and to really underscore that she had multiple versions of many of her poems for different audiences. So I mentioned the broadsides earlier that represent the form that often would be the first publication of a poem. That would be a sheet, and it would be circulating and people would be reading it. But then when she's writing for the book, and as Mona mentions, it's going to be published in London, she's aware that her first readers are going to be British. And as her amazing biographer, Vincent Coretta, has demonstrated in one of his editions of her work, she did many changes to individual poems to tweak them for the audience that was going to be reading them in the book form. And so it's a powerful opportunity to remind students as writers that you're writing for an audience, and sometimes you're revising, and that you want to think about how that audience is going to respond to a text that you're working on. And Wheatley demonstrates that in very tangible ways. And then I'll also say, in terms of the book, when you look at the wonderfully available editions that you can access online now, students are initially puzzled by some of the fonts and the presentation in the late 18th century format. And so inviting them to think about how some of those now available versions that we can look at are both exciting to see and give us a sense of her moment. They also sometimes get in the way of our access to the poetry. So how they get past that and becoming aware of themselves as readers, I think, is a really useful opportunity that Wheatley provides in the classroom. And related to that, I will say sometimes I've been surprised by the poems that students find the most accessible in terms of content. I've had several students say this past year that it was such a wonderful gift to be able to tap into their own spirituality through reading Wheatley, that in our secular age, a lot of the things that they're studying in their literature courses are really avoiding anything connected to religion and spirituality. And for them, for many of my students, it was almost a relief to be given time in a literature class to engage with someone who is drawing on the Bible, who is, you know, addressing issues of spirituality. And then on the flip side of that, I've had students respond with great appreciation to her engagement with political topics and her, Barbara mentioned earlier her will, and her will is both a personal will, but it's also becomes a will for the nation and what the nation will become. And you can track the shift from her identity, her clear self-positioning as a British subject. She even writes and celebrates King George, right? To shifting, to seeing herself as an American and wanting the new nation to enact a vision of democracy. So one of the poems I like to teach came out originally in 1784 in a broadside. So after the book, right, is called Liberty and Peace. And she's really calling on a broad audience of Americans in the new nation to think about what the nation can be and what democracy can be. And so picking up on Mona's modeling of let's hear her voice, right? The closing four lines of that poem, Liberty and Peace, call on the new nation as Columbia and say, auspicious heaven shall fill with favoring gales where'er Columbia spreads her swelling sails. To every realm shall peace her charms display and heavenly freedom spread her golden ray. And if you just Google that title, Liberty and Peace, Wheatley, that poem comes up and you can look at it and read it carefully and notice, for instance, her use of italics. She's italicizing freedom, right, as a key word in her last line. And when you see words like heavenly still a part of her discourse, but we see that image of sailing that she's appropriating and using in a positive way, despite her personal experience of the Middle Passage, but supplemented by crossing the Atlantic as an author, we can see her vision for a positive future for America. And I know that one of the important roles that she would play if she were with us today is to promote democracy and to encourage all of us to treasure it and protect it, because she understood its value. And she speaks to that in this late poem.
Yeah, that's a fascinating point. Thank you for sharing that. And that did, in those questions I sent to you ahead of time, one of them was, how do you think, if you get in, this is an imagination exercise, because we of course don't know, but if she were around today, how would she be interacting? I think in this, I believe Sarah is maybe one of the pieces I read of yours in research, and we've talked about how she was always knew the movers and shakers and who to talk to, you used the term influencer to use the modern lingo. She knew all the influencers, and I feel like the all the various ways that we can on social media or other sites where we can get our ideas out, our words out, blogs. I'm curious what you all think, how she'd be engaging with our current world.
Sure. I'd like to answer that question, but first I'd like to circle back to the last question, because I found my colleagues' responses fascinating. And the question is a very good one. What do we do with Wheatley in classrooms? Because her language is so different. And I would add that in many instances in my own classes, the students find her language off-putting. I think many of my students come to the table in regards to the poet with what I call Wheatleyitis, because they only ever heard one poem, and that poem is On Being Brought from Africa to America. It's the poem that is the most widely anthologized. It's very short. It speaks to so many themes that my colleagues have raised: spirituality, freedom, will. But they've been bombarded with it to the point that they don't want to hear it anymore. So, like my colleagues, what I like to do is lean into the challenges that Wheatley presents. She is a very different voice compared to the literature that we read today. We can't avoid that. Let's work with it. I like to think about form because I think people get stuck trying to figure out what she means. So I go into the form. How does she use couplets? 'Twas mercy brought me from my native land, taught me my benighted soul to understand that there's a God, that there's a Savior too, once I redemption never thought nor knew. I give them an opportunity to try to write a couplet. It isn't easy. And so we backpedal then and we think about, as my colleagues have pointed out, how is she using punctuation? How is she using italicization, capitalization, not merely to convey one meaning, but several meanings at a time? And what really opens their eyes is when you set her poetry next to the poetry of contemporary Black women writers of different generations, like Lucille Clifton, again, a child of the Black Arts Movement, Tracy K. Smith, very contemporary writer, former U.S. Poet Laureate, writing and working today. And the students see the similarities. All three of these writers are using form to convey meaning, thinking very carefully not only about what they're saying, but where. How are they placing the words on the page? What is the architecture of the poem? I find that when we get students to think about poetry in that way, it really opens them up to the playfulness that Phyllis Wheatley had. They think of her as, oh, so serious, so old, so yeah. Neoclassical. She was very playful. The joy of being a writer is so clear in her literature. And the challenge that we face as teachers and as aficionados of Wheatley is bringing that to audiences today.
I love that. That's a great point to bring up, playfulness, because I would agree. I think prior to meeting you all and research, my thought of her in my head was kind of, old, like, centuries old, kind of stuffy language, right. Maybe. I don't know if that's the right word, but yeah, you're right. She was that language of her time, she was playing around with that and having fun with it. I love that you brought that up, the joy of it. Well, we're getting close to wrapping up here, but were there any other, quotes or lines you'd like to read of Phyllis Wheatley's?
Well, I would just like to say two things. One, I would love to read out her joy in being a person, somebody who was visiting London for the first time. And she writes here in a letter in 1773, she says, Grenville Sharp Esquire, who attended me to the Tower and showed the lions, panthers, tigers, etc., the horse armory, the small armory, the crown, scepters, diadems, the fount for christening the royal family, saw Westminster Abbey, British Museum, Cox Museum, Sadler's Wells. It really gives us an understanding of this young person who is barely 19, visiting a foreign city for the first time and enjoying the joy that she feels in seeing these things. And that actually brings me to a point that I would really like to make. For a lot of Americans, we all come from elsewhere in many ways, or have ancestries from elsewhere. And in that sense, Wheatley is a very powerful figure for this moment in time, because what she really encapsulates are these different worlds that she belongs to and brings together beautifully in her thoughts, her words, her writing. And in that sense, she's quintessentially global, but quintessentially American, quintessentially African American, quintessentially British. I love that. And how many of us, those of us particularly with long different diasporic and immigrant backgrounds, can really tap into that at a moment when we find ourselves thinking through our identity, and we see Wheatley working through that, both with her joy in encountering strange and new beautiful places, but also finding the calm, the efficiency, the beautiful artistry to express that in her poetry.
Yeah, that Sarah, again, this reminds me that before we break, I want to be sure to mention that Barbara talked about the waves of different response eras for Wheatley. She's having a moment right now. Yes. It's not just about the anniversary. It's about many, many artists reconnecting to important social issues and points about the role of the and the power of literature that we can come to appreciating through connection with her, and people being inspired by her life and by her writing to create new texts. So certainly Honoré Jeffers, as Barbara McCaskill mentioned earlier, the wonderful book, The Age of Phyllis, which includes both new poetry and an incredibly inspiring account of what it's like to research the life of someone like Phyllis Wheatley. We have events this fall that I hope people will come to virtually, including September 7th, when the amazing Allison Clark and Drea Brown will be reading and talking about their poetry inspired directly by their study of Phyllis Wheatley Peters. And new plays, Ada Solanke, speaking of podcasts, there's a three-part podcast on our website from playwright Ada Solanke, who is in the midst of working on a new play about Phyllis's time in London. And then also the world premiere of written by Phyllis that occurred recently in Philadelphia, written collaboratively by Paul Oakley Stovall, Marilyn Campbell Lowe, with input from director Cheryl Lynn Bruce. And the next production of that will be in your current hometown in Chicago this fall. And I hope folks will go to it, because I think dramatizing Wheatley's life, and what's particularly powerful about the written by Phyllis play, is that her voice is woven throughout that play. Her words, her poetry, her letters. So she's speaking directly to the audience. So I encourage people to connect to her through the contemporary now poetry that's being written and the dramas being performed, because she is having a moment.
And we're going to have another moment as a nation here in the United States in 2026, right? An important birthday anniversary. So I agree with Sarah that this is no better time to think about Phyllis Wheatley. Phyllis Wheatley spent so much of her life in Boston, which is connected to the cradle of the American Revolution, but it's also the cradle of the American anti-slavery movement. And it also is the cradle, was for many generations, the cradle of American publishing. So the places, as Mona has pointed out, that she's connected to are so very important. I'd like to give her the last word. I'm looking at a collected works of Phyllis Wheatley volume that was published in 1988 as part of the Great Schomburg Library series focused on early African American women writers. And on a page of poetry that she published outside of her poems on various thoughts, religious and moral, she has a poem that she published on July 15, 1769, called On Friendship. And here it is in the midst of poetry that many of my students would find, as you said, rather stuffy. Two elegies are also on this page. But here is a poem on friendship. And two of the lines read, "When to my thoughts in gratitude employ, mental imaginations give me joy." So there you go. She was a lover of learning, a lover of language, a lover of culture. It was her beacon. It was her anchor. It was her mooring. It was her hope. And I can't think of any better model for all of us as we struggle here in the United States and on the planet with climate change, with the various good and bad implications of migrations, with so many weighty issues, to remember one reason we turn to literature and one reason why Wheatley's words stay with us is because of the joy that she brings.
Wow. I don't know how to follow that up. That was great. It's a great, great ending. Well said, and I love that. I hadn't come across that poem in my reading of her. So I'm glad that you shared that one. That one's great, and yeah, and inspiring. And yeah, it's worth it to imagine a different options. You know,
yes,
you know?
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah. Well, but before we wrapped up entirely, was there anything else that anyone wanted to mention? And listen, for our listeners, we'll have links in the episode description for how to engage with the Wheatley Peters project, how to all the events that you have coming up. I'm looking forward to them. So,
and the beauty of our website, as Sarah has pointed out, is that it coheres so many activities across the country and in the world around Phyllis Wheatley Peters. So it's a great one stop for folks that listen to the podcast and want to know more about Phyllis Wheatley.
Yeah.
And the archive will still be there at the end of the year. I mean, the events are happening now, but we're, you know, the recorded versions of many of the many events and other resources. So we hope it'll be living organic archive. And I just want to thank you, Nate, for this opportunity for us to share our appreciation of Wheatley Peters. And thank you for the work that the museum is doing to celebrate authorship and writing. It's really such an important contribution. Thank you.
Now more than ever, we need institutions.
Now more than ever.
are putting forward the humanities and culture. Now more than ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you all for your kind words, and thank you for joining me on this episode of Nation of Writers.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Nation of Writers podcast, part of the American Writers Museum podcast network. If you would like to learn more about American writers and their impact on our history, our culture, and our daily lives, find us online or come see us in person. The American Writers Museum is open Thursdays through Mondays from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., closed on Tuesdays and Wednesdays. Once again, thank you for listening, and to all you writers out there, thank you for writing.